As the table is set for a Passover Seder, someone counts out knives, forks, spoons, plates, and bowls, and makes sure that there are enough places set for the number of people who are expected at the meal. Someone also counts out cups for wine, one for each person who is expected, and then does something that may seem a little odd. He or she adds one more cup and puts this extra cup with all the others that will be filled at the time in the Seder when someone says, "All those who are in need, come and eat." This is the cup that's made ready for Elijah the prophet. And since no one knows what Elijah looks like, any stranger who wishes to join in the Seder will use this cup for the toast next year in Jerusalem. Who is Elijah, you may ask? Is Elijah someone who was invited at the last minute? While there may be people at the Seder who don't know who everyone else is, this place is not set for one of them. Jews await the coming of the Messiah, and it is Elijah's role to announce that the Messiah is here and that the temple in Jerusalem will be rebuilt. Elijah is the stranger in our midst, the person who has had to leave his or her life behind and begin again, learning a new language, becoming familiar with different customs and practices, and grieving for a life that was and is no longer. Surely Elijah must wonder, as he raises his hand to knock on yet another unfamiliar door, what kind of welcome he will receive. He moves from place to place. He is never sure how this group of people will deal with him. He is sharing the sense of uncertainty with every other refugee who has ever arrived at a new place, with the possessions that will fit into a pocket or a bag. People can become refugees for any number of reasons: famine, war, disease, earthquake, flood, the list is endless. People may have been tortured or abused, imprisoned or sent into exile, with threats of what may happen if they refuse to leave everything behind. For refugees seeking asylum in a new country, it is no longer possible to make some adjustments, to give something up for the greater good, or to try a different way of life without leaving everything behind. This is different from what people experience when they choose to uproot themselves and their families. When I joined the Peace Corps and went to live in Ethiopia for a few years, I could count on the structure of the program itself to provide some stability. I learned to say, "Tenaist alin yendemen alef." People answered me, and I learned to speak back to them, and I can still do that when I recognize people from Ethiopia. Most of them drive cabs in Atlanta, and I have an interesting time talking to them. When my Peace Corps service was over, I went to live in Britain, but I still knew that if I chose to return to the United States, since I had not changed my citizenship, I had a country to go to. Things were very different when I did just that nearly 15 years later, but my identity as a citizen of the United States, that was still intact. In the United States, we may think that our circumstances are chaotic, but in fact, the stability that we enjoy is markedly different from the situations that have driven hundreds of thousands, millions of people to live as refugees and to seek asylum in exile. My wife Susan and I had a very brief experience with the life of refugees many years ago when we offered a temporary home to a family that had fled Afghanistan in 1990. Kalandar, the husband, his wife Kamala, and their son Harun, who was then 15 years old, were part of a group that was sleeping in a succession of church basements. And we were friends with a woman who had served with the Peace Corps in Afghanistan. Susan Aronson spoke Farsi, and she told us how Kalandar, who was a civil servant in service with the government, had been threatened with death by members of the communist regime that brought about the downfall of the Afghan government in the late 1980s. The Aronsons still had small children living at home, and they knew that all five of our children had begun to live their lives independently. Do you think you could let them stay in a couple of your spare bedrooms? Susan asked. And it didn't take my wife, Susan, and I long to agree. Kamala and had already started English classes. Harun was fairly fluent. He was already registered for high school. And Susan Aronson agreed to translate for Kalandar. He did not want to learn English. And he thought that would only last for a few months while the social service agencies in Poway and San Diego find this family a place where they can really begin to live a new life. In 1990, the idea that people coming to this country and seeking asylum were terrorists was not something we thought about. My Peace Corps experiences in Ethiopia gave me confidence about our ability to get along well with Afghan people. We had the pleasure of learning how Kabili Palau tastes if an Afghan woman prepares it instead of me trying to follow the recipe. And since Kalandar wanted to get his driver's license worse than anything, we had a way to encourage him to attend English classes. I taught him how to drive, and I told him that I would give him one driver's lesson for every session that he attended an English class. And that turned out to be enough incentive. He did get his driver's license on his very first try. We also learned something about the very deep cultural differences between our two families. We had a very, very, very pregnant daughter-in-law with our first grandchild. And Kalandar said to her when they came over for dinner, "We wish your family well. In Afghanistan, boy is good." Well, for us in the United States, our daughter-in-law told him, we would be just as happy with a daughter as with a son. And by the time our granddaughter was born, Kalandar knew better than to express his disappointment about her gender. I don't honestly know how they would be received, Kalandar, Kamala, and Harun, if they showed up here in Hendersonville today. And one reason that Charlotte and I are bringing this question to you this morning is I don't know what you think about all this. I don't know who in this congregation might offer concrete support. I know that there are communities in Canada where a group has to come up with enough money to be able to support a family for a year. On average, those groups raise around $30,000 to pay rent, to furnish a home, to buy clothes, and for transportation. They provide enough money to get that family through its first year in a new culture. In this congregation, we have never discussed this question. I don't know what you think. I want to know what you think. I don't know what your concerns are. I know what mine are, but we've never talked about this. We are fortunate enough in this congregation to have someone who has actually lived through these experiences. And so Charlotte Self, whose cousin Hane, who lives in Germany, has shared her experiences with Charlotte. Charlotte will speak next about what might be involved here.
Thank you, Helen. Can you hear me? Okay. And my thanks to all of you for being here and for giving me the opportunity to tell you why and how a small town in Mecklenburg in northern Germany is taking in and dealing with so many refugees. Mecklenburg has a 75-year continuous history of dealing with refugees and migrants. I grew up in northern Germany, in Schwerin, which is the capital of Mecklenburg, and I was there during the Nazi era and the Second World War. I saw my first refugees at the end of 1942, when I was 16 years old, when desperate people came from Poland, East Prussia, and from the Baltic states, frantically trying to get out of the war zone. I can still see these haunted, homeless, cold, and hungry people. They had to leave their homes and everything they loved behind. Some came by train, but most of them were walking, pushing their few belongings on bicycles and their babies and their belongings in baby buggies, and some were pulling their toddlers in small wagons stacked with pillows. One woman only had one pillow, and so she cut it open and put her baby right in it and then closed the neck around it. And you just saw this little head. It was funny, and yet I cried. It was a very natural, though never discussed, fact that we opened our doors and offered them food and shelter. Many of them stayed only for a few days, unless they had relatives in the area. But most of them wanted to move as far west as possible. I did not sleep in my own room after the fall of 1942. It was always occupied by refugees, who sometimes changed on a daily basis. Then followed the catastrophic fire bombings of Hamburg in July of 1943. There were 43,000 civilians, and they were literally burned to death. The towns and villages of Mecklenburg sent many trucks and cars, as many as they could muster, to the outskirts of Hamburg, my mother in her small car included, and they picked up as many air raid victims as their vehicles could possibly hold. We got 7 people, I remember, 1 couple and 5 women, and they had all fit in my mother's little car. They all slept either in my room or on the floor in the loft, and they all shared our kitchen. And then in April and May of 1945, as the Allied troops came upon the concentration camps, both in Germany and in Poland, they opened the gates and these starved and beaten people, many still in their striped prison suits, flooded our town. Who would not open their doors and their hearts to them? When I fled Schwerin in 1945, the population of my hometown had grown from 52,000 before the war to well over 100,000. And that number has declined only by around 10% in the following 70 years, while migrants and refugees are coming through. German Chancellor Angela Merkel was born and raised in East Germany. Age-wise, she fits exactly between my 2 children, so I can call her the second generation. But having grown up in the same place, our backgrounds are not all that different. Chancellor Merkel is and has been considered a logical, very cautious, and pragmatic leader. And yet, when faced with the latest migrant and refugee crisis, Chancellor Merkel stepped in and opened the door to 1 million refugees. By the end of 2015, Germany had received 1.1 million refugees. The Chancellor decided that Germany would welcome refugees from Syria because they are casualties of radical Islamic bestiality and not the carriers of it. Am I surprised? No. Am I proud and grateful? Yes, you bet.
Helen? We are here this morning thinking about these things in relation to our presence here in Hendersonville. We're one of many faith communities here. What might this mean for us? How might we respond? As we consider what support the German government offers to refugees and people seeking asylum, to volunteers like Hannah, what are we called to do here as members of our own faith community? At some point, when they are able to be with us, we'll hear from Charlie and Pam Rogers, and they'll talk to us about Karen Armstrong's Charter for Compassion. Compassion comes from a Latin root meaning to suffer together. In English, it is defined as to have sympathy or to want to help a person or people who are going through a difficult time. Karen Armstrong has written extensively about religion, and she suggests that faith communities include compassion as one of their core values. She also suggests that practices or texts that diminish one's sense of compassion should be eliminated from religious discourse. At the same time, it is essential that we weigh our sense of sympathy for people going through hard times with concerns about how to protect ourselves and those we love. If an individual or a group threatens to harm us, we would do well to take steps to prevent us from being harmed. And those issues are the very ones that we're here this morning to consider as refugees from Syria, from Afghanistan, Iraq, Somalia, other countries in the Middle East and Africa are streaming into Europe from camps in Jordan, Lebanon, Kenya, more places than I can name. They're trying, all of them, to make new lives for themselves and their families. As Charlotte told us, German Chancellor Merkel has stated that Germany welcomes these individuals and families. Other countries in Europe have set up barriers or announced their intentions to take small numbers of those seeking asylum or to insist that they turn over everything they possess to people at the border if they are allowed in. Canada has lowered barriers to refugees, and the United States is continuing its policy of extensive vetting before anyone can come here. Different candidates for the presidency have announced their very differing proposals on what our policy should be. Charlotte is going to continue to tell us some very specific steps about how the German government assists volunteers who are offering support to these refugees and those seeking asylum.
The town of Güstrow, it would have an umlaut in Mecklenburg, which is at the center of this presentation, has a population of approximately 28,000 inhabitants. I cannot and do not wish to discuss how the rest of Europe or the world is handling the refugee crisis. And I cannot even speak with authority about Germany as a whole. But I can speak about Mecklenburg, especially Güstrow, because you see, I have a connection. Güstrow is where my cousin Hanne lives. Hanne is 8 years younger than I am, and we knew each other from family gatherings. But with an age difference of 8 years, we really did not have too much in common as children. After 1942, we did not see or hear from each other for 50 years. When the wall had finally fallen in 1989, Germany was reunited, and travel between West and East became possible, and I was on my way. Little Hanne had married Mr. Hannemann. I thought she was kidding. She had become a teacher at the School of Agriculture, raised a family, and was a grandmother. For some reason, Hanne and I took to each other like ducks to water. I wanted some first-hand accounts of what really happened behind that iron curtain without somebody giving me some political version. And Hanne was, of course, fascinated by my stories of life in Southern California. When I saw her last summer in Bonn on one of my short visits to Germany for yet another family reunion, she took me aside and she said, "We are doing something interesting with refugees in Güstrow. Let me send you some information." Here is what she told me. In letters, by email, on the phone, from newspaper, updated 48 hours ago. On September 16, 2015, the town was instructed by the Department of the Interior to establish the largest refugee emergency receiving center in the state of Mecklenburg and be ready to receive the first refugees by September 28. That is exactly 12 days. You see, when refugees arrive in Germany at the borders, mostly in Bavaria, they are quickly registered and put on trains and then sent to a receiving camp that has vacancies. Thank goodness for computers. Now, not everybody gets on that train. Mostly the young men think that, oh, I can do this on my own, and they start to walk. But in the long run, if they want to eat and want a roof over their head, they have to be at a receiving center. After the federal government, on instruction of Angela Merkel, had assured the town of Güstrow that funds would be made available without red tape, the townspeople went to work. The German Red Cross immediately hired 18 people with refugee experience who then undertook the training of the volunteer workers. As luck would have it, in a village nearby, the annual agricultural exhibit had just closed, and the four huge exhibition tents were commandeered for the purpose of becoming the first refugee emergency receiving center, after this to be referred to as the center. The tents had toilet facilities and could be heated. Each tent would accommodate 350 refugees. Therefore, in those tents, there was room for a total of 1,400 refugees. 1,400 camp beds and chairs were purchased from a factory in the Czech Republic, which actually built prefabricated houses, but they promised to deliver within a few days, and by gosh, they did. Cups, plates, knives, forks, spoons, drinking glasses, towels, and bedding for 1,400 people were very wisely purchased from smaller businesses in town. And this was, as Hannah put it, a warm rain for the local business community. If there had been any local resentment at all before that, it was certainly gone now. Huge field kitchens were brought in by the army, and the receiving center of Güstrow opened punctually on September 28, 2015, and has been functioning fully ever since. The plan was and is that 350 refugees will arrive per day, be processed in 4 days, and then leave the center for more permanent housing. It doesn't always quite work out that way, but somehow they manage. On the first day, the refugees are duly registered and are given a very thorough physical exam. The local physicians volunteer for this. The local population was and is, to this day, much more afraid of tuberculosis and AIDS than they are of terrorists. Everybody who has a positive chest x-ray for tuberculosis is immediately transported to a sanatorium. And if a positive AIDS test turns up, isolation, treatment, and counseling start immediately. Once the registration and the medical checkout are completed, the refugees are given the very important asylum applicant status and are settled in asylum housing. Preschools accept all duly registered children, and elementary schools have special classes for those who do not speak German. The public high school also gives classes to adults, primarily in the German language, especially to those who only know the Cyrillic alphabet. Almost all of Europe and the Americans use the Latin alphabet. Both men and women receive work permits immediately, and may work in any field for which they are qualified. They must know some German, and that is the hardest part. But they may be employed in the field for which they have been trained at home. Or they go into the building trades, or they work on the land. Mecklenburg was and always has been the breadbasket of Germany. I cannot stress enough that the main purpose of the education, the medical care, the housing, and the work opportunities is to make refugees independent and to integrate them as much as possible in the local community. In Germany, it takes from 18 months to 2 years for an application for asylum to be processed. But at least these people, our human brothers and sisters, can live in dignity while they're waiting. Here it goes. I have been asked repeatedly just why all this matters so much to me, and why I feel so strongly that the United States should play its part in helping, or at least easing, the overwhelming refugee problem. Because, you see, I have been a refugee myself, and unless you've walked in their shoes, you cannot possibly know. At the end of the Second World War, my mother and I still lived in Schwerin, Mecklenburg. My mother continued her medical practice, and I had become a Red Cross nurse aide in one of the many military hospitals in town. The fear of the approaching Russian army hung over us like a cloud. At the end of 1945, the American army reached Schwerin first, and it was replaced by the British at the end of May. Under the British occupation, all members of the German army, and that included the Red Cross nursing personnel, were declared British prisoners of war. The Russian troops took Berlin in a fierce battle, and our worst nightmares became true as they marched into Mecklenburg. At the end of July of 1945, I watched from our front window the retreat of the British and the takeover of our town by the Russians. A sight I shall not forget for as long as I live. It was so humiliating. For the Russians, it was payback time, rightly so. And for they shot many hopelessly wounded soldiers right in their beds in the military hospitals. They raped women cruelly. And of course, there was continuous looting and burning. My mother heard that young German girls, especially those from the more privileged families, were deported to Siberia. This was not just a rumor, it happened. In early August, the British sent one Red Cross train into Schwerin to bring out their prisoners of war, which included all military personnel, mainly wounded soldiers, and the Red Cross nurses. We had 1 hour. My mother, always in the know, brought me a small suitcase and a note with the name of a couple in Hamburg whom she had helped during the air raids. We did not have time to say goodbye, and I ran all the way to the station and just managed to get on the train, my Red Cross uniform being my only identification. The next several days are not very clear. I remember the Russians fired at the train with machine guns, although the carriages had a big Red Cross painted on the roof. All of us who were packed into that crowded train were hungry and thirsty. The wounds of the injured began to fester, and they were only wrapped in paper bandages. Somebody had lost their crutches, and I could not move because at my feet was a girl hidden in a duffel bag by one of the soldiers. Once we arrived in Hamburg at some military barracks, we stood in endless lines to be registered, to get a bowl of thin soup, to go to the bathroom, to make our daily report, and on and on. I slept, fully clothed, still in my nurse's uniform, way at the top of the bunk beds, without pillows and blankets, and I do not remember for how many nights and days. And then one day, a British soldier, a Tommy as we called them, handed me a slip of paper with the address of a Mr. and Mrs. Schnoor. Bless the German bureaucracy, who register everything and everybody, always. And the British military government, who picked up that system and stuck to it. And that's how they found them. I found the Schnoors, who lived in a very small, one-roomed garden hut, way on the outskirts of Hamburg. Both the man and the woman cried when they saw me. And Grandma Schnoor hugged me and hugged me and held me and said, "We'll take care of you." Can you imagine the comfort of that? They put a blanket and a pillow on the floor for me to sleep on. And they shared their potato soup and their weekly ration of 200 grams, that's 6 ounces, of ground horse flesh. Their love and kindness restored me. And now you know, while I feel so strongly, that every refugee deserves a pair of open arms somewhere. Thank you.
It's our responsibility to ask the question of how we will respond. This is not going to go away. The refugees from Afghanistan, from Syria, from Iraq, are not going away. And we live in the wealthiest country in the world. At some point, everyone who lives here must answer the question, what will we do? And since we are part of the faith communities here in Henderson County, that's a question that we as a congregation are going to have to answer. And I don't know what we will say. And the reason I don't know what we will say is that I have no idea what you think about all of this. We've never discussed it. I don't know what your opinions are. I don't know what you're afraid of. I don't know what you think we should do. We could consider preparing ourselves for the possibility that our community could offer assistance to a family seeking asylum here. We could find ways of talking to one another about our fears, our concerns, and our wishes. I believe that our core values and principles as Unitarian Universalists call us to do this. Last week, we told you a little something about a Unitarian and Universalist minister named Thomas Starr King. He answered the question of his day, which was, should California come into the United States with slavery or as a free state? He answered that question for his congregation, and that means that he helped his congregation to talk about it. Yes, he had pro-slavery members in his congregation, and yes, they talked about it. They talked about how they felt about slavery and what to do. Thomas Starr King answered for the 19th century. We have to answer for the 21st. For now, I'm leaving you with that question, but I think we have to answer it. We want to express our appreciation to you for being here today, to listen to the story that Charlotte had to tell, to listen to the story of one little town in Germany where people said, yes, in 12 days, we will welcome thousands of people seeking asylum. I hope that we can find a way to talk to one another about this. I think we have to. And I think that as we do this hard thing, we will be bringing our best selves to these questions.